G'day and welcome to A Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's A Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen with the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Jessica Burnside, who is doing a Master of Science in Epidemiology under the supervision of Dr. Sahar Saeed. Welcome to Grad Chat, Jessica.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. Yeah, looking forward to the chat.
That's good. And, you know, the term has already started and things are happening across campus. And so hopefully the start of your new term has been going okay.
Yeah, I defended my thesis in the summer.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm back in Kingston for the first time since then. So it's been nice to be sort of back in the buzz and in Kingston, and it's beautiful this time of year.
It is a nice buzz having the students back. Sometimes I think, no, there's too many of them, but it is nice. It does sort of create this different atmosphere, doesn't it? I mean, summer is lovely because there's so much we can do here in Kingston. But then when the term starts, I hate to say it, before we know it, it's going to be holiday time.
Yeah, the winter word, yes, yeah, I know.
It'll come pretty quickly. So before we start talking about the research that you did, what made you want to go into epidemiology? Because it was a bit of a buzzword during COVID.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good question. So I did my undergrad in life sciences, which is sort of the study of human biology, if you think of it that way. Mm-hmm. So obviously related to health. And then after I finished that, I worked in an analyst position. So doing a lot of like data analysis, more from the business side.
Right.
And so I had an inkling that I wanted to go sort of further my technical skills.
And looking at data.
Yeah. And so epidemiology felt like a nice marriage of those two things. Still continuing to do a little bit of analysis, learning new skills in that, but also being true to sort of my health background. And as you're correct, all of this happened sort of during the pandemic, and I'm sure that was a bit of a push as well.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a buzzword, the way everything carried on, and I'm sure there's going to be other opportunities. Although it's interesting because I know epidemiology, you think of epidemic. Not everything falls under that kind of category or that high level category, does it?
So like epidemiology means a lot more than just studying infectious diseases, which is what we often think about for epidemics. So things like a cold, a flu, something we transmit quickly from one to another. It can be environmental. So thinking about like air pollution, climate change, and how that affects health.
Right.
So there's really a lot of different sort of categories of study under the broad term.
And I think that's where a lot of people don't realize, as you mentioned. It's interesting. We have these programs, and we're using words that people have an association with or an assumption of what they are, and then we realize, oh, it's that as well.
Yeah, it's a funny aside. Despite sort of the popularity of the term during the pandemic, a lot of people think of as someone who works with skin when they hear epidemiologist.
Oh, yes, yes.
Like the epidermis. So I get that a lot, actually. And I'm like, no, that's not quite what I'm studying. But I see the connection.
And that's where I think, you know, understanding words, the meaning of words is so important. And I'm going to let everyone in on a secret. When I first read Jessica's overview of her work, even down to the title, which I'm going to explain in a minute, I was a little bit worried because I was a little concerned that I wasn't quite sure what you were talking about, which is one of the purposes, of course, of having an interview like this is to practice how do we tell people about the work that we do that's understandable. And there was nothing wrong with what you wrote. It was just in words that I had to really think hard about, or as I've done in the past, look up Mr. Googly or Mr. Wikipedia and hope that they explained it well enough for me to be on the right track. So hopefully they did me proud and gave me some good definitions. So the Your research topic is the burden of steatotic liver disease in Canada, sex differences in prevalence and cardiometabolic profiles. Mm-hmm. So before you tell us what all that means,
yes,
can you give me some definitions here?
For sure.
For instance, what is steatotic liver disease for starters?
Yeah, so steatotic liver disease is sort of an umbrella term. So it encompasses a number of subgroups of people with this particular type of liver disease. And all steatosis is referring to is fat accumulation in the liver. Okay. To a certain extent that it then can sort of cause downstream effects, like further damage to the liver. So really, it's just encompassing a number of different, what are called etiologies of liver disease, meaning right. how they are developed. So different etiologies of liver disease under the term of steatotic liver disease.
Okay. And I know later on, you talk about, what do you mean by cardiometabolic profiles?
Mm-hmm. So as when we start to talk a little bit about some of those etiologies of liver disease, one of them is highly related to metabolic dysfunction in our body. So things
like an imbalance somewhere.
That's right. Yeah. So when we think about when we have conditions like obesity or diabetes, that's often related to metabolic dysfunction. So cardiometabolic is an even broader term.
Not to do with the heart.
It is, yeah, because a lot of the times when we have this dysfunction, cardiovascular disease is one of the main concerns.
Oh, okay, right. Mm-hmm. Is that because of the fatty tissues yeah. that you were talking about?
Yeah, hypertension, highly related, right, so high right. blood pressure.
Which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Which
so makes it's just sense. Sort of encompasses that hypertension aspect
so
as well.
So that's a secondary problem because of this steatotic.
Yeah, well, we might get into that, but there's lots of debate about like the chicken and the egg.
Right.
So is it the liver fat that comes first? Is it sort of other dysregulation that causes the accumulation of fat in the liver? But that's a big debate.
A big debate. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there's another area here, which I didn't mention in the research topic, but it's something called metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. Mm-hmm. Or MASLD.
Right.
Which used to be called something else.
Yes. Yes.
So what is that?
Okay.
Which I know you'll explain a little bit more
yeah.
in relation to your work.
Yeah. So steatotic liver disease, we're familiar with that. That's the ending part of the term that you just mentioned. Metabolic dysfunction associated is telling us how they got the steatosis in the liver. So it's the most common type of SLD is MASLD. Metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease.
Right.
So yeah, that fat accumulation in the liver up to a point where it accounts for 5% of the liver's weight and highly related to the cardiometabolic dysfunction. So that's the definition of MASLD.
And you mentioned also too, this buildup of fat in the liver often happens with people who have diabetes or high blood pressure, obesity, mm-hmm. those kind of things. Do we have any statistics on that of how many, because we always talk about when we talk about cancers or this disease and that, mm-hmm. 1 in 10 people in Canada will have blah, 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 or mm-hmm. likely have. Do we have stats and things like that?
Yeah, so that's very much at the core of my work. Yeah. So global estimates for the prevalence, so how many people have MASLD, pinpointed at about like over 30%. Which is a really significant
Globally,
number of people.
30% of the population.
That's right, yeah.
Have this.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, is there more prevalence in one country over another? I mean, is it a Western issue or is it?
So for a long time, I think it was thought that the prevalence was higher in Western countries. But I think the prevalence is quite high globally across the board.
Right.
And sometimes even in like South Asian countries as well.
Okay, well, that's not good. It's across the board.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although maybe it'd be easy to figure it out a little bit better.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting things about this topic is most of us haven't heard about the term, mm-hmm. and yet it's
so prevalent.
It's very prevalent, yeah.
So I'm just going to recap your research topic again. The burden of steatotic liver disease in Canada, mm-hmm. sex differences in prevalence and cardiometabolic profiles. So give us a bit of a background. You know, what were you... what you were trying to do there. What was the background of you even going into that topic?
So there hasn't been in epidemiology, you want your prevalence estimates. So how many people have the disease to be what's called generalizable.
Right.
So that means that when you calculate how many people in your study population have the disease, you want that population to be sort of reflective
of the whole population,
so that it can be generalizable to that population.
Right.
So in Canada, we actually, up until this point, haven't really had an accepted prevalence estimate completed. And there's a lot of different reasons why that's been challenging. So one of the reasons is to truly diagnose fat in the liver, it often uses imaging techniques.
Okay.
So things, liver histology, which would be like a biopsy, is technically the gold standard, but it's not something you could apply in a population level study to people who are otherwise healthy, right? And then even imaging techniques, things like using adapted MRI or even ultrasound, can be quite costly for large studies of people.
Yeah, until you get a good cross-section
of the population. Mm-hmm. That's right. So this sort of next step down and how we might identify the disease is using non-invasive tests that are based on blood biomarkers.
Okay.
So we look at sort of enzyme levels maybe in your blood.
So when the GP says you need to go and have a blood test, and we just go and check a few things out, usually they mark something on the chart for the people who are testing the blood. But if they don't mark off, are they looking for the fatty whatevers, then it's not going to show up, is it?
Yeah, so there are a couple liver enzymes that your GP may look for in a regular checkup. They're called alanine aminotransferase and aspartate aminotransferase, if
Fantastic.
You're interested. But yeah, those are the types of things that are measured and sometimes included in these scores that we try to calculate based off of a blood test.
But if they're not always marking that off, then it's not going to be recorded, is it? Is it something that they would normally look for? Or because that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if you're wanting, if this is the only cheap method of doing it, then you want them all to do it to get a good breakdown.
So I think what you're sort of referring to is sort of what data source would be good to measure this prevalence. So administrative data in Canada is where our health records are stored.
Okay. Yeah.
So there are certain institutions that store your health records, things like what your physician orders would be stored there.
Right.
Now, screening in the general population, so all of us, for steatotic liver disease is not currently recommended.
And why is that when there's 30% prevalence across the globe?
So there's a couple of different reasons. One reason is there's a good portion of people with steatotic liver disease who will not progress to the most sort of advanced forms of the disease that would require sort of specialty management of the condition. There, up until this point, haven't been specific treatments for steatotic liver disease approved.
Okay. Right.
So if you screen someone for a disease and then you don't necessarily have a unique treatment for them, it might not be ethical.
Right.
So things like lifestyle modifications are a treatment, but so those are some of the reasons and the cost as well of screening that many people.
But if we know if you look at the people who, for instance, obesity or diabetes, would those people fall into, yes, we should test for this?
You're getting right to it. You're a sleuth. You know the crux of the problem. Yeah, so many international organizations, including the European Association for the Study of the Liver, the American Diabetes Association, have recommended screening for MASLD amongst people with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, because they're a high-risk group, and the burden is much higher in that group.
Right. Okay, well, that's good. Okay, so that's the background.
Yes.
All right. Now, exactly what are you trying to do in your research? Because you're looking at Canada and you're looking at sex gender differences. Why are you looking at that?
Yeah, so I sort of report two measures of burden. So prevalence, which we already discussed, how many people have it. Incidence, which would be how many people sort of acquire it over a certain period of time that you're looking at, prospectively looking forward. And then it's important when you're describing this population to not, depending on the factors that you know influence the disease, to not just provide overall general estimates, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, so, geography and everything can have a difference, can't it?
Right. And a really big one in this topic area is the sex difference between males and females.
Right.
And despite that knowledge, a lot of epidemiology studies don't either have the sample size, so that means the number of people in their studies, to provide separate estimates for males and females. And so that was like a driving force for, I was fortunate to have a large enough sample size to do that appropriately.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. So what are the key takeaways that you're finding in the data that you have got to describe, as you mentioned here, the population with MASLD in Canada?
Yeah. So I think we can start with the sort of overall prevalence for males versus females. And when it has been documented that males have a much higher burden
of
steatotic liver disease. So in my sample, it was about 46% of males versus 24% of females. So almost two times.
Yeah.
Wow. I will mention that the population I was looking at was over the age of 45.
Okay, because I imagine the age would have a significant, well, two things I always think have a significant, well, three, the gender is one, age, and then where you're actually living. I mean, the environment to me has a huge impact when you talk about lifestyle, of the lifestyle part. You know, is this population have more access to unhealthy foods, or only has access to unhealthy foods as opposed to healthy foods, or they can't afford medical attention as the same way, or it's not even available?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. So the sex, so males versus females, definitely a big contributor. And then age and how that relates to sex. Menopause is a really big event that affects the burden of this condition. So we all
know.
What about
men going through a midlife crisis?
I'm sure.
I don't know how you measure that.
I'm not sure how we measure that. But menopause, we know that there's hormonal changes when that occurs. And for females, estrogens are actually very protective for developing some of these cardiometabolic dysfunction in the body.
Right.
And the reason is because it protects the sort of depositing of fat in your abdominal region, which is more problematic for the liver and some of your other sort of functions related to cardiometabolic health.
Aren't we lucky?
Yes, yes. But menopause, unfortunately, your estrogen levels change. And then after that, you're at much higher risk for this condition and related conditions.
And so if you're looking at the population over the 40s, I mean, you've made the obvious one with a woman going through menopause, the change. But was there really anything else? Anything else that was that could be significant?
For that age group? Or I mean, I think there are a number of things. So when we're talking about this type...
Well, I'll put one forward. When people retire, I like to think the stress levels go down, and maybe that's enough to make changes, because maybe you're spending more time sitting around or eating more than you would if you were at work. I don't know. I'm reaching.
I think a retirement is an interesting event to consider, because it could have an effect in a lot of different ways. So maybe you have more time to exercise, but maybe you also have more time, like you're in the home, you're not able to regulate your eating in the same type of way.
Right.
But also it can have an impact on people's income, and we know healthy food can be very expensive.
Which I've never understood, how healthy food's more expensive than processed food.
Yeah, no, for sure. But this is what you're referring to from the environmental behavioral influences of the disease. Back to where we started, right? Compared to an infectious disease that we transmit to one another, a chronic disease is really a product of like a lifetime's worth of exposures or ongoing sort of contributors, whether those genetic, environmental, behavioral.
Or not. So from a public health and policy perspective, because at the end of the day, whatever you've collected, you want something to happen with it. It's great collecting it, but we want something to happen. So what would be the next steps in the prevention and management of MASLD and the interrelated cardiometabolic conditions? Now, so I know you've only talked about the gender differences, but what are you expecting to come from all of this? Because clearly you would have gone into this project for two reasons. One, you know, what is the prevalence and why? and if there's differences? And then the second one, well, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, I might have to expand a little bit on some of the key takeaways in terms of the burden. No problem. First, if I could clarify, when I did a sort of sub-analysis to look at gender, which I conceptualized separate from sex. Because sex is sort of referring to our biological attributes that we're born with, and gender is more referring to our like social experience, the norms, behaviors, institutionalized power, those types of things. So the sort of one area where I was able to do an exploratory analysis of the effect of gender was actually related to income and its association with Maslow prevalence. So we found when you look overall, the burden of Maslow is higher amongst people with the lowest household income. But when you stratify by sex, which is what we had talked about at the beginning, so that means separate estimates for males versus females, you can see that the relationship between Maslow prevalence and low income is much stronger amongst females compared to males. And so that sort of points to a bit more of a gender effect on who these people
always
are.
Always earning less.
Yeah, and how that affects, and how low income affects disease development potentially differently in males versus females. And that gives us a sense of sort of the gender experience. And then the other key takeaway I might highlight that I think relates to your question, which is, you know, what are the next steps? How can we like actionably move forward, is unsurprisingly the extent of sort of metabolic dysfunction amongst the people who have Maslow.
Okay, so what else is going on? You're saying other things are happening in the body.
So I looked at the Maslow group and said, okay, how many of these people also have diabetes, also have obesity, also have high lipid levels in their body, also have hypertension. And sort of how this is sort of the term of comorbidities or multimorbidities. So having more than one sort of disease influencing you at one time. And there was a really high extent of that occurring in this population as well.
So were they having more than one, or they were either diabetic or they had hypertension, or is it a combination? That
It's actually, I would say, about 30%, sorry, I'll repeat that, about 30%, without knowing the exact number off the top of my head, of people with Maslow's had all five cardiometabolic. So I think it's important to sort of zoom in this way and say, okay, like Maslow is highly prevalent, right? So it affected a number of people. There's differences between males and females. And then there's a subgroup of those people who have a high level of
all the contributing factors.
And so then we start to think about, in terms of public health and policies, how can we target those people? How can we treat multimorbidity, because all these things are interrelated, without being in our silo of people who study liver disease and people who study diabetes, et cetera.
Because if you look at the five things, some people will go, well, let's work on diabetes, let's work on hypertension, as you said, singly, as opposed to, well, maybe we need to look at them all together of how we can change that. Because what were the, I don't, you may not know this, but what were the rates of people who only had one or two of those out of the five?
A very low. It was only 1.9% of people with Maslow only had one other. And some of that is sort of baked into, one, the definition of the disease requires you to have at least one other. And some of these, the score that I was talking about, the blood-based score to define Maslow also sometimes includes things like your hemoglobin A1C level, which is tells you about your glycemic control. So how well it's used for example, managing in people with diabetes. So some of that is baked in, but I think regardless, it's a really high number of people with all of them. And so in terms of a public health perspective, you know, I'm not a physician, but they've started to come out and emphasize sort of care guidelines for multimorbidity instead of sort of single disease pathways and how to sort of treat and manage those.
That's not easy, because usually it's probably left up to the GP to start with, right? And if people don't go for annual checkups and, well, first of all, they've got to get a GP. But if they don't have annual checkups, that's going to be a bit of an issue, isn't it?
No, for sure, for sure. And I think also in terms of obesity alone, it's taken a long time for it to even become recognized as a disease itself.
True.
And not just sort of something stigmatized towards personal habits that are modifiable and sort of a disease that instead needs to be diagnosed and treated. And so I think there's a lot of sort of factors that can make this pathway to actually maybe identifying and treating these conditions quite challenging.
I know you said this is a global issue, but and you're looking at the Canadian context. And I'm going back a little bit here. Did you see any differences, if you had enough data, between provinces?
Yeah. So the cohort that I examined was called the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging. In case there's any other grad students out there who want to use that data source, it was a great data source. And so to calculate the scores that I require to define steatosis, people had to attend an in-person physical assessment. And these centers were only located in a certain number of the provinces in Canada. So I did look at geographical differences with the caveat that Saskatchewan, for example, and the territories were not...
were not part of it.
Were not part of it.
So you're only... and were most of the ones they were captured from urban areas?
And definitely a limitation, yes. So the Canadian Longitudinal Study of Aging, I should say, does have a bigger cohort of people who do telephone interviews, and they can be from anywhere in the provinces. But because of the data I required, these people did live within 25 kilometers of these collection centers, which does mean that they tended to be healthier, wealthier, more urban than the general population in Canada.
So it could be very different if we were able to do a better collection, which is not for you to have to do. so, but it's a good question though, right? Because, I mean, you are limited by the data that you've got. And so, you know, what have you learned about epidemiological approaches to studying diseases that cluster with comorbidities or descriptive epidemiology? And I'm bringing, that's in general, but we are limited by the data.
That's right. Yeah. To comment on that first, I mean, some of the imperfections in the previous studies were part of the rationale for conducting this work, but no study is perfect. And if there's a better data source out there that in future could be used to get a better estimate for this disease incidence, prevalence among certain subgroups, that would be great. One thing I hope that's taken away from my project is some increased awareness and public health momentum, which could lead to, you know, future studies, including the imaging techniques that are required to diagnose it in a different way. But in terms of some of the things I've learned from sort of what we consider a methodological perspective in epidemiology. So how do you actually do this if you want to replicate it in a similar context? You know, I think the chicken or the egg problem is really challenging because it becomes, are you identifying MASLD or are you identifying sort of the association of a lot of different related parameters, and how do you tease them out separately, diabetes, obesity, when they have similar effects maybe on things like our hemoglobin A1C and how we sort of manage insulin
in
our body.
It's just difficult, isn't it?
Really challenging.
Because I would imagine, I mean, you knew the limitations, but it need you, some, like you said, you've created at least hopefully an awareness that this is an issue out there in Canada and we don't have good stats on it. This is what we're seeing with the sample that we've got, but it could be worse. It, hopefully it's not, but it could be worse. And in which case, what are we doing about it? Because unless things are highlighted and made and aware, nothing changes.
Yeah.
We just go, oh, that's another stat, but it just fits in that bucket. We don't do anything with that bucket because we don't have time for that bucket. It's not big enough for us to have time. Wrong way of thinking about it, but that's often what happens, right? Where do you put your resources? You put your resource in those that
are practical questions. And even something that comes from a prevalent study like this is now you have data that you could use to do a cost-benefit analysis, for example, in understanding if we did this intervention, which is basically like saying applied maybe a specific program or testing regimen or whatever it may be to try to reduce the burden or treat these people, how much would that cost and what would be the benefit? So without those stats, it makes those types of studies challenging to even understand the effect of a potential intervention in Canada. But I think the other question is something I've wrestled with a lot, is talking with friends, you know, ultimately these are just a lot of what my thesis was, and we didn't talk about everything, but was some descriptive stats of like, who are these people? How many?
Right.
And I think trying to understand like, what's the value in that? And I think the value is that, yeah, you need those types of things to start the conversation, to keep the conversation going.
Right.
And I think this type of epidemiology is often more digestible for the general public.
Well, it's not something that's immediate, right? Like when we had COVID, mm-hmm. it affected everybody, but this is still just as important before it gets to become epidemic proportions.
Right. And I think while the terminology is heavy in this topic, yeah. right, Masled, SLD, there's more, I think, you know, understanding, you know, what percentage of people does this affect,
right.
who are they, I think is something that can translate to people who might not be liver specialists but are still in the health community or
right.
even broader than
and
that.
And what can we be doing to keep the fattiness out of our livers?
Our livers. Yes, yes.
We don't want to be weighing down our livers. They do extremely important things.
Yeah.
And we've got to look after them.
The liver is a special organ. It has a crazy ability to regenerate. And
well, I wonder what else it means. You're right. The liver is an amazing organ. And, you know, what else can this organ tell us about, you know, when we go in and do little biopsies on it and things? I'm sure it can tell us an awful lot.
I would imagine so, because it's involved in sort of detoxification
yes.
of our bodies. And
which is where it used to be called non-alcohol, whatever, wasn't it, in the liver?
Yeah.
Which was weird to even put the word alcohol in if it wasn't affected by alcohol. So.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right. So they changed the language in 2023. And
right.
part of the reason is because they didn't know back when they first identified the disease what was causing it. So they defined it by what wasn't causing
what
it.
What wasn't.
So it's called negative diagnostic criteria.
Oh, well, that doesn't help sometimes.
Yeah. So
people just remember one word. They forget the non in front.
Yeah. And so I think when we talk about, is this the right moment to be talking about Masled? I think there is a lot of public health momentum
yes.
because we have new terminology that might be easier to understand, although the abbreviations are long. It's maybe a bit clearer as to exactly what this condition is.
So what's next for you?
Because mm-hmm.
you've defended.
I have defended.
So what's next?
Yeah. So I'm fortunate to continue working with my thesis supervisor currently.
Right.
So I've started a professional role at Queen's.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can keep it going.
I can keep it going. So I related to liver disease. Dr. Saeed has a TIHR grant looking at screening amongst people with diabetes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, for fibrosis, which is
right.
a more advanced
that
stage of steatotic liver disease,
right.
so scarring in the liver. And so I'll be doing some work with administrative health data, if you remember, so
yes.
the hospital records,
yes.
To understand what are the current practices.
So you're really using everything that you've learned in one, I would say, a small project, but an important project.
Yeah.
To be able to go next steps.
Very fortunate to continue working mm-hmm. on that. And then I think looking further than that, I'm really interested in sort of policy work and
great.
Working in government settings. So we'll see.
Well, you got the background for it. Then you go and tell them like Dr. Jane Philpott did, right? She went into politics, which would never be an easy thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Look what she's doing now and being able to use all her experiences
yeah.
to try and make change.
You never know where things
where,
will lead
where,
you. And I didn't think I'd be studying Masled. And I'm sure the topics will change over time, but it turned out to be really interesting.
I'd imagine once you've done it once, there's a lot of similarities in how you go about something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Getting started. Inertia is...
One of the first things you need to think about, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
So, well, good luck with all of that.
Thank you.
I think that's awesome that you're back in town and you're able to sort of keep going. Particularly if you are passionate about this and you've got other aspirations too. So
mm-hmm.
good luck with all that, Jessica.
I appreciate it and appreciate the platform to chat with you today. It was great.
No worries at all. I love it, as you know, and it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. So
I take that as a compliment.
You should take that as a compliment. Thank you. That's brilliant. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ, signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.